This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, day 58 now of the Deepwater Horizon blowout. 58 days of helpless yearning for a solution. Last night, the president made his biggest play yet to take control of a crisis that has not been controlled, that so far is beyond control, and to put it in terms that may frame the future. This hour on point, the president's Oval Office address and America's oil mess. You can join the conversation. What did you take from the speech last night? Is the president getting on top of this crisis? Is the country? Joining us today are three big picture, big idea voices to help us take stock of this big moment. Joining us from Austin, Texas, is historian, presidential historian, Douglas Brinkley. He lived in New Orleans and taught at Tulane University when Hurricane Katrina hit. He's now a professor of history at Rice University. Stephen Ambrose called him the best of a new generation of American historians. His latest book is The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. Doug Brinkley, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
From New Orleans, Julia Reed joins us. She's a contributing editor for Newsweek, Mississippi. Born and raised, now lives in New Orleans. Her father, Clark Reed, was a three-term chairman of the Mississippi Republican Party and a driving force in the rise of the GOP in the South. She is author of The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story. Julia Reed, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's the first time I've ever been introduced as my father's daughter, but I'm delighted.
Well, we'll go to that. And last but not least, from Toronto, Naomi Klein joins us, best-selling author and columnist for The Guardian and The Nation. She's just returned from the Gulf region, where she's been reporting on the oil spill and its effects. Her piece will run in this Saturday's Guardian. She's the author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and No Logo. Naomi Klein, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So I'm seeing all kinds of headlines off the president's speech last night. Paul Begala, nothing but net in president scores. Here's Joan Walsh in Salon, just words. Obama's Oval Office speech fizzles. Naomi, let me come first to you. What did you make of the president's, you know, first big rhetorical address to the nation from the Oval Office on this subject, this crisis?
I think it felt small for a big speech, and it felt small because he failed really completely to make the connections between this flash flood of poison and the slow drip of the effects of the oil and gas industry in the region. I mean, he made some passing statements to it, but he really in no way took the gloves off with the oil industry. He used all this militaristic language, which is, you know, we've heard from Ted Allen and we've heard from him before, waging war on the oil spill, which is attacking us. You know, oil is an organic substance, and the truth is we attacked it. And he didn't announce that he was waging war on big oil, and he didn't lay out a visionary plan about how he was going to get the whole industry, really, to pay for the slicing and dicing of the Gulf region, and also this slow drip of poison that affects communities like Mossville, for instance, that are surrounded by 14 petrochemical plants and are really being poisoned every day. So, and not to mention the effects of what happens when even safely extracted fossil fuels come out through smokestacks and tailpipes. He talked about the need for an energy policy, but I was struck that he didn't use the term climate change once. So I think he looked defensive, and it looked small.
He said what's going on here is worse than most natural disasters. Let's listen.
Unlike an earthquake or a hurricane, it's not a single event that does its damage in a matter of minutes or days. The millions of gallons of oil that have spilled into the Gulf of Mexico are more like an epidemic, one that we will be fighting for months and even years. But make no mistake, we will fight this spill with everything we've got for as long as it takes. We will make BP pay for the damage their company has caused.
Tough talk, maximal talk. Julia Reed, what did you think sitting in New Orleans listening?
I agreed that it was very small, and I don't mind actually the militaristic terms. If we had a little bit more like military organization to wage war against just the sprawl of this, and I don't think that there's still such a disconnect between what a lot of the country seems to be imagining is going on down here and what Obama seems to be imagining, even despite his brief trips. This is completely out of control. One thing that he said that really struck me was that from the very beginning, the federal government has been in charge of the cleanup. Well, I don't think I would have taken credit for that if I were him, because the cleanup is a disaster in its own self. And people, there's no central command. There's no information chain. It's like it, when you go down and see places like what's going on in Grand Isle, which has gotten the brunt of this, it looks like the Keystone Cops are out there, and nobody knows what the other arm is doing. It's already a bureaucracy run amok. And people like the governor of the state, parish presidents now, their counterparts in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, are still having a terrible time getting information. I mean, one of the things the president took credit for was okaying the sand berms that Jindal called four weeks ago. Well, that took more than 3 weeks to okay. So it still feels very, very slow and very chaotic to the people on the ground.
Douglas Brinkley, how about it? I mean, here's the president, you know, Naomi and Julia here, the speech is kind of small. The president's saying, you know, fight with everything we've got for as long as it takes. We'll make BP pay. These are kind of maximalist statements. Did you hear them as small?
Oh, I thought it was a small speech, too. So we're all in agreement. I thought it was fairly well written. I mean, I always look at these things from a young speechwriter working on this, and there was a bit of an attempt to be Reagan-esque with the military imagery up front and the talk about faith in God and the fishermen at the end of the speech. So you can look at it as a written document. And in that regard, a lot of it was quite fine. I think it was important that the president mentioned at least on conservation, the fact that we're going to have to start doing a Gulf restoration. They may just be words. They are just words at this point, but at least he put that on the table. But all in all, it fell flat. Maybe people like myself and Naomi and Julia are maybe the three of us are micro-following this more. Maybe the speech was geared to people that are watching sports and sitcom TV and haven't even been following the spill, but it seemed kind of like a third grade type of speech, not something that adults wanted to hear. I was looking for it to flesh it out, to find out, you know, what is the new command center operation? Here's the president speaking to the nation when we now know it's 60,000 barrels a day. We originally started at 5,000.
That's quite a leap. 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so why isn't that being addressed? Like, I would have rather heard the president say, look, it's up to 60,000 now, but we are at least realizing how much it is. It was a speech aimed at being optimistic in minimizing the catastrophe. Well, if you're living in Alabama or Mississippi, and particularly Louisiana, to have the president minimize this, it's baffling, because I know he does feel the pain, if you'd like, of the fishermen and of the small motel owners. And when he's gone down to the Gulf South on his four trips, he has connected with people one-on-one. But he retreated back up to Washington and kind of gave a safe, flat speech where the last third of it was about a green tomorrow, when the Mississippi River floodgates need to be opened up, sediment needs to be immediately flushed into those wetlands, or we're going to lose one of America's most treasured and important landscapes.
Well, you say everybody's talking small and minimizing. But, I mean, he also put it rhetorically in big terms. Let's hear just a little bit of this, if I can. He's saying he's open-minded, proposals are taken from either party, the whole energy challenges out there. And he made references back to some of the biggest challenges and achievements that the country looks to.
The one approach I will not accept is inaction. The one answer I will not settle for is the idea that this challenge is somehow too big and too difficult to meet. You know, the same thing was said about our ability to produce enough planes and tanks in World War II. The same thing was said about our ability to harness the science and technology to land a man safely on the surface of the moon. And yet, time and again, we have refused to settle for the paltry limits of conventional wisdom.
Naomi, I mean, there we got planes and tanks in World War II and landing on the moon. That doesn't sound like small references.
Yes, I think there have been extravagant displays of machismo from the beginning. For some reason, Obama feels that this is the way to deal with this. You know, from the beginning, he's going to put his boot on the neck of VP and looking for somebody's butt.
Who's that? That's to kick, you know.
Exactly. And I think people feel it as cliches at this point, because people are smart enough to know that nothing is going to happen until you take on the entrenched interests that are blocking change. And let's remember that this comes in the context of us having watched for a year and a half Obama fail to take on those interests, whether it's the health insurance companies when it came to health care reform, or whether it's the big banks when it came to financial reform. So that's the context in which we hear these remarks. I feel like, you know, what Douglas was saying earlier about minimizing the risk is so important for us to understand, because this is what created the crisis in the first place. I mean, if we go back and read BP's exploration plans, they read like a Greek tragedy about the dangers of hubris, right? I mean, again and again, you know, I counted five times them saying no risk, the phrase little risk, again and again, assuring us that the fish and shellfish would metabolize the oil, which is quite a frightening thought.
Quite a meal.
The oil would not reach shore because it was 48 miles away. Can you imagine having so little faith in the power of natural forces that you think the oil can't make that little trip? So that's how we got into this mess, and that's how Obama got himself into this mess, by believing this sort of best-case scenario, sunny optimism, we're in total control rhetoric coming from the oil and gas industry. So to now hear it from him, we have it completely under control. The next fix is going to work for sure by August, when we already know that it isn't for sure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's Oval Office address and America's oil mess, the giant mess in the Gulf. Julia Reed joins us this hour from New Orleans, contributing editor at Newsweek, author of The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story, kind of a post-Katrina memoir of that city. Historian Douglas Brinkley joins us from Austin, Texas. His latest book is The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. We'll ask about Teddy Roosevelt. And Naomi Klein is with us from Toronto, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We'll have to look at that. Naomi, Julia, Doug, lots of comments here. Drew on Facebook says, I don't get it. What do people expect? What can an address by a politician do? What has any politician ever done except flap his, her lips? As a leader, Obama did the only thing he could, talk to people. Obviously, the problem is bigger than any existing technology fix. Doug, you've got a historical perspective here. I don't know, put it in terms of any president you like, maybe Teddy Roosevelt. You know, what's a president supposed to do in a moment like this?
Well, first off, I know all three of us will agree with this. You know, we've got to plug the hole, as they say in the Gulf South. Mm-hmm. But it's whatever it takes to get that shut and stop traumatizing the Gulf and the Gulf residents is priority. And I think in that way, the president needs to be stronger than he's been. He seemed to me to be a couple weeks behind the news cycle. Things that pundits are saying, he finally does 2 weeks later, and it seems late, and it seems forced and reluctant in some ways. Theodore Roosevelt, if we're dealing with conservation, would have used executive orders by now. He would have come in and pinpointed that these natural wildlife refuges, in fact, these barrier islands off of Louisiana and Mississippi, Roosevelt saved as president. He called them federal bird reservations. And then even as ex-president went down to the barrier islands with the Audubon Society and studied the great flocks of terns and saw the egrets and heron, he had a feel for the land and nature, Theodore Roosevelt. President Obama is very citified. And
he's been down four times in 58 days.
You got to love it. You have to love
the
land.
That's not a lot. Mm-hmm.
You have to love the land in a way that you can't just see this as an oil and gas field, the ragged boot heel of Louisiana. You have to see it as a magical, natural wonderland that it's a treasured American landscape that needs preserved. And we're going to maybe talk about the moratorium in a minute, but I think right now, if you're saying what Theodore Roosevelt would do, he would earmark treasured landscapes like the Chesapeake Bay or Arctic Alaska, and say no. Shell is not going to drill outside of our nation's biggest offshore drill off of our only polar bear denning area in the Arctic. No, you're not going to drill in the Chesapeake. Pick the great American places and say no. Then start looking in the Gulf of Mexico, which has become an industrial field, and see how you can quickly start doing offshore drilling that's safe and sound. But that you, not every natural place should be up on the map for discussion with big oil. And in this regard, President Obama has really abandoned the environmental movement that he professed to be part of when he ran for president. And he's quickly losing liberals in the left that put the natural world and preservation of it very high on their list of presidential priorities.
He said last night he was told, he was assured that there was not going to be risk attached to this. Here he is.
A few months ago, I approved a proposal to consider new, limited offshore drilling under the assurance that it would be absolutely safe, that the proper technology would be in place, and the necessary precautions would be taken. That obviously was not the case in the Deepwater Horizon rig. And I want to know why. The American people deserve to know why.
Julia Reed, I mentioned your pop's political background at the top of the show just because you've got a deep Republican, Southern heritage in the family. I think you carry it on. What do you want from the family, from the president at this point? I mean, Douglas Brinkley says, you know, make the Arctic off limits. Chesapeake, but we're coming out of a Republican time of relatively low regulation that some people are saying that's the reason we're here. What do you want in the emergency, Julia?
Well, I mean, I wish that Obama had made good, and his interior secretary, who I'm wondering why he still has his job, should have made good on his promise to clean up the mineral management system, which had definitely been trashed in the last decade and more. The reason that we're here is because BP, you know, was not held to safety standards that they're held to anywhere else in the world if they drill. You know, it's been a year and a half. I mean, you can blame Bush for a whole bunch of stuff, but Obama's been at the wheel for a year and a half, and he signed off on that drilling without knowing, with just sort of trusting that everything was okay.
Does it make you rethink the Republican approach to regulation? Should Obama be reversing all of that?
I don't have a Republican or a Democratic approach to regulation. I think that in this case, I mean, I've lived here long enough to know that the government entities that are supposed to be taking care of me and that I pay my extremely large amount of taxes to have failed. I mean, first with the Corps of Engineers. I mean, we're not even talking about the banks and all that kind of stuff. Let's just stick right here in River City. The Corps of Engineers had not done for decade after decade what they were supposed to do. And there was outrage about that, but not so much. I mean, you know, I kind of agree with James Carville, who's kind of gone a little ballistic down here, and I don't blame him, that, you know, if this had happened on the Chesapeake Bay or definitely in the Long Island Sound or in Long Beach, California, each time with Katrina or with this, there would have been more response. I mean, I think people would pay more attention to it. I mean, there was outrage about the Corps of Engineers, but not so much unless you were really, you know, on the ground here. Most people don't have any idea what the hell the Minerals Management Service is. But in the short term, having said that, this 6 months, I mean, you know, I'm all for exploring alternative energy and thinking big and going to the moon again, which is what he said last night in the speech. But it takes a while to get to the moon, and we're not even close to that. So in the short term, when this region has already been decimated ecologically and economically, which is a twin disaster, believe me, to shut down offshore drilling for 6 months, no matter what you think about it in the long term, it's here and now. We still need gas, and these people still need to make a living. We're talking about in the short term, a 6 month moratorium would be 100,000 jobs. That is crazy. And you go down there to these people who do love the land more than anybody I've ever known, like Douglas said, but they don't want that to happen because they want to eat. You know, people need to go to restaurants and eat and pay taxes and do all the things that an economy requires to be. I mean, this will be the single worst thing that Obama could do to react in reaction to this.
Naomi, we asked you in part because, I mean, you wrote the book, Shock Doctrine, talking about disaster capitalism and what happens in these sort of moments of chaos and confusion when something big and bad goes wrong. In those terms, what do you see happening here, Naomi?
Well, I mean, the roots of this crisis are in a moment like that. The whole drill, baby, drill moment was harnessing the crisis of high oil prices. That's when Gingrich and co. went in with this slogan, which was precisely a call not to think. You know, don't think drill, drill now, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that was the call. Mm-hmm. I mean, in at the Republican convention in 2008, when you had this sort of frenzy of drill, baby, drill, I mean, they would have drilled beneath the convention floor if they could have, right? So there is, once again, an enormous wasted opportunity for Obama, because he's not in a position to name that problem because he fell for it. Right, because he gave into it, and he did believe those assurances, which, frankly, from a president, is an absurd claim. He shouldn't be believing what is said to him. He needs to believe what he knows, what is proven. So he just looks weak when he says that, and he is weak when he says that. So, obviously, the Republicans, I think, share enormous responsibility here, but we're caught in this trap of Obama's so-called bipartisanship.
I want to know what's going to happen right now. President sitting down today with BP. He said very flatly last night, you know, they will pay. Let's listen to a little of that here.
Tomorrow, I will meet with the chairman of BP and inform him that he is to set aside whatever resources are required to compensate the workers and business owners who have been harmed as a result of his company's recklessness. And this fund will not be controlled by BP.
Okay. Douglas Brinkley, does the president have the authority to just kind of say that in the voice of God, this is how it's going to be? What if the chairman of BP says no?
Oh, this has already been figured out between the White House and BP last week. Lawyers are dealing with some aspects of who the third party, where the money's going to go. Mm-hmm. Most people think it's a $20 billion deal. I think the president's going to be in trouble if it's much less than that, because expectations have been stuck now on that figure on Capitol Hill.
Yes, they have.
But don't think the president just is wandering in to meet BP today and then suddenly they come to agreement. This is already was prearranged before President Obama came south, and it's just a matter of announcing the figure. I find it the most heartening part of the president's speech that at least BP now is going to be, looks like it's going to put $20 billion or something close into a fund, and some more money will start going to restaurant owners and motel owners, some commercial fishermen and the like, which is a temporary salve that does help this economic problem. But the second part, and some of that money's got to be directed at it. Julia nailed it when she said the Army Corps of Engineers, that the Army Corps has to save where they've destroyed. This channelizing of the Mississippi River for big shipping and treating the oil and gas industry, treating the wetlands as just a dump zone has to end. This is the fishermen's communities. This is wildlife's moment in the sun. This is the Mississippi River Delta. If we can't protect the Great Delta of America, it's like when the Great Lakes were on fire in the 60s and we had to clean them up. And you can't just do it by sending boats out picking up tar balls.
You're saying unplug the Mississippi, take away a lot of that channelizing, let it flow down, wash out the region, bring in new sediment. You see the solution in the Mississippi itself, Doug.
I do. It's the in the Atchafalaya Basin. We have to repair the damaged wetlands. You know, the slogan goes, you know, Louisiana loses 2 football fields of land a day, or we've lost as much land as Delaware, we've lost the size of Delaware. There are all sorts of these. Bottom line is every day the Gulf is getting closer to New Orleans, and the levee system's not going to be able to hold up. The barrier islands and wetlands were for national security. The barrier islands were speed bumps for hurricanes. The wetlands used to soak up the surge. The disappearing of it, you know, the class action suits have forced the shutting of the Mississippi River Gulf outlet. The Army Corps of Engineers built it not for protecting of New Orleans, but to put a easy route from the ocean to New Orleans. But every biologist, when it was built, said, don't do it. You don't want the saltwater infusion with freshwater. You'll kill the cypress trees. You'll kill the marshland.
Can it really wash out all that oil now? Can it really do that job, mighty as it may be, the Mississippi?
It's the only solution. We're going to have to do, once it gets in that marshlands, we're going to have to fight to rebuild that. So if you want to use war analogy, then let's fight to save the wetlands. We heard the president intimate that, but for some reason, no conservation details are ever put on the table. You can go back and hear President Obama talk about on the campaign trail. He went to Tulane and said that the city is going to have Category 5 levees.
Yep.
You can pull it up.
Mm-hmm.
Where are these Category 5 levees? We don't need to hear of the kind of rah-rah talk that the president gave.
We are Americans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we want action now. This is the most abused section of the United States, period, is the wetlands of Louisiana, and it's because none of the money stayed in state from gas and oil. They've treated that area as if it's some third world place, and the time has come for the president to say, Louisiana, I hear you. I am saving the wetlands. Be Walt Whitman. The wetlands are us. That water that comes out the mouth of the Mississippi is the Ohio River. It's the Missouri. It's the Illinois. We are only as good as our wetlands at the mouth of the Mississippi.
Doug, stand by.
It's a fight to claim it right now.
I got to say right here, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And let's get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Ed, you're on the air.
Yeah, my name's Ed Montana. I'd just like to make a couple of quick points.
Mm-hmm.
We're all talking about all this dramatic speech and action that everybody's talking about spread out all over the whole Gulf. But the main point we need to concentrate on, and I called BP and the White House both in the last couple of
mm-hmm,
days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all wanted cheaper fuel. We've got an organization called NASA. They have more technological expertise in underwater work than anybody in the country. That's where our space astronauts trained. I had family that worked for them.
So what do you want from them?
Well, I think that, you know, NASA, if there's anybody out there, as well as industrial engineers, could develop a valve and figure out a way to deliver it to the end of that pipe. I mean, this is what we need to do.
Get the oil stopped. Let us pick that up, Ed, and thanks for calling. Naomi, is there a fix, a technology fix that NASA or, you know, the Manhattan Project or I don't know who has up their sleeve that they're just not delivering here? Are you looking for that?
Well, it's been interesting because people have suggested this and have asked, you know, why the military isn't in charge, and if they took over, would they have this, you know, would they be able to explode the well? And, we've all heard all this. But it's been interesting that they haven't been interested in stepping up. And I do think that we may be seeing an extraordinary example of what happens really when you let the public sector expertise decay, to the extent that the public sector really is at the mercy of the private sector. I mean, that's what I felt more than anything.
But should we have a Department of Deep Water Drilling Rescue that stands by forever waiting for this? I mean, is that reasonable?
Well, I think if you're going to go into these high-risk areas, put all of these other industries at risk,
it
isn't crazy to say that expertise has to be there, and not just
other states require it.
What do you say, Julia? Require
other states require it. I mean, Alaska requires more ships to be on call. BP, I mean, you know, again, this goes back to the Mineral Management Service. It goes back to our federal laws. States, if they wanted more standby attention, had to pass their own laws. I mean, it's crazy to me that there was nothing. I mean, everybody's like, oh, it's going to be fine from, as Naomi points out, from the president on down. Then we read about the emails today that the congressional committee has released, showing an extraordinarily cavalier attitude on the part of BP. Well, we don't want to wait 10 hours. Well, I mean, we want to save money. I mean, it's shocking.
But that was the idea. Drill, baby, drill. Let the oil companies go.
Well,
get off their backs.
I mean, but right now, I got to come back to a point that's just killing us down here. Right? I mean, whatever you thought about deep water drilling or drilling in Alaska, let's just go with what we've got right now. In the short term, he's talking about what we can't stand for inaction. All right, so I didn't hear very many specifics in his long-term energy policy, but we've got wells that can be, that are mostly are safe. You can take a month and go check the safety of that out without decimating an economy right now, and we still need oil.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's Oval Office address, America's oil mess, the giant mess in the Gulf. Naomi Klein is with us, author of The Shock Doctrine and No Logo, joins us from Toronto. Julia Reed is in New Orleans, contributing editor for Newsweek, a New Orleanian. author of The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story. And Douglas Brinkley is with us, a historian, presidential historian, now professor at Rice University. His latest book on Teddy Roosevelt is called The Wilderness Warrior. Here's a web comment from Jim. It says, Obama has not failed. We, the people, have failed through our apathy, lethargy, mindless consumerism. We fight amongst ourselves over petty political schisms and have let the corporations run amok. Let's go to Newtown, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that the Center for Public Integrity has released a report that shows that 97%, this is a quote, of all flagrant violations found in the refining industry by government safety inspectors came at BP facilities, including 760 wow. violations rated as egregious and willful, compared with the second worst offender had only 8. And I just wanted to make one last very quick point. Yeah. I find it outrageous when I hear the cleanup workers, people whose livelihood has been destroyed by BP, coming ashore and I'm hearing stories, well, they can't talk to the media for fear of losing this replacement employment cleaning up their BP's mess. And I would suggest instead of Beyond Petroleum, Bound for Prison perhaps is the better acronym. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I mean, Julia, that's the point at which I think James Carville's got it right. I don't know how much you can tell BP I'm your daddy on, but at least on open up the facts here. We talk about transparency. We need to know exactly what's going on. Nobody should be mum down there.
That has been one of the most shocking things about it. I mean, not only did, you know, imagine what would have happened if George Bush had said, okay, you know, Katrina, you journalists are just going to be stopped at the line. I mean, the only people who could get into this city, thank God, were people like me with the press pass. I mean, and the reporting out of Katrina was extraordinary. We can't – I mean, I was – when I went down to Grand Isle, I was told absolutely I could not go to the beach. I had to literally sneak on to – I mean, you know, some days you can get on there, some days you can't.
Why obey that? I mean, just – you're a journalist. Just walk on and do it.
So I did, and the woman told me I was going to get arrested. So I said, okay, fine. I mean, you know, that would have made my day. But
we had a boat come up to us. We were in the open water in East Bay.
Yeah.
A boat came up to us saying – do you work for BP? We said no. In the open water.
Yes.
Said, you can't be.
Bill
here.
Nelson is a United States senator, and he was barred from taking a journalist out on a boat.
Douglas Brinkley, has the president changed that atmosphere? I mean, that just seems like the worst nonsense. Is that different after last night's speech?
It's not different, and it is the worst nonsense. Look, David Gergen, who's served a lot of presidents, a Republican and Democrat, has been correct when he's been calling for a need for a command center, a central organizing place in the Gulf, and the United States government has to open this up to journalists, has to offer full transparency. We shouldn't be having Congressman Markey or others having to demand the video feeds from, you know, below the leagues in the sea. I mean, this has been just a complete boondoggle from beginning to end. But I think our callers really hit on a really important point, and that is BP has really been an awful corporation. I'm writing on Alaska some right now, and looking at Exxon Valdez. And I have to say that when you look on at ExxonMobil and Shell, their safety records are nowhere near nothing, even in the game of what BP is. And it's not just that BP had the blow up in 2005 in Texas City and the ruptured corrosive pipes in 2006 in the North Slope of Alaska. They have them all over the world. They became a company that's like Enron or WorldCom. They're fake. They created the BP, where don't call us British Petroleum. We're Beyond Petroleum.
Beyond that, yeah.
And all of that phony green mark tomorrow commercials, and a lot of people bought it like they were a green company, when in truth, they were the worst, by far, offender of every kind of environmental measure or safety measure aboard rigs.
But I'm still thinking that the drill...
And that was all on record, which is astonishing.
The drill, baby, drill mantra, though, they could ride right into the middle of town with it. But I don't know. Let's go to Matt, Clarksville, Tennessee. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see, Matt?
The way I understand it, you know... President Obama doesn't really have any place to tell BP what they're going to do. He's not a member of the judicial branch of the government and can't make or pass or do anything that has anything to do with that. He's the executive branch. He can make, you know, a point that he wants to do something, but he's got no way to institute it.
He says we're going to war on an assault on our southern shores. Does that sound like a writ to power, Matt?
I don't think it's an assault or a war on our southern shores at all. I think it's an incident that occurred that we're going to have to take care of. But
Would you just leave it to BP then? Would you do that? Would you leave it to BP and say, just let us know when you've got?
I think Louisiana had it exactly dead on. What Jindal did is activate his guard members, which should have been, he shouldn't even wait it. He should have just gone ahead and done it. If he had to sit there and wait on the Corps engineers and everybody to make a decision, when he knew what the right thing was to do, is to go ahead and activate the guard members and put up the barrier.
Well, if Bobby Jindal can act, I don't know why the chief executive of the country couldn't. Naomi, what do you see there?
I think we're seeing politics in action. I think that there is absolutely no reason from the very beginning why BP has been in charge of this cleanup operation. They should be paying for this cleanup operation. They should be writing the checks in the background. But that doesn't mean they should be running the entire show and putting people on the Gulf Coast through the humiliation of, after having their livelihoods destroyed by this company, having to line up and beg for the right to get a low-paying job from the very entity that destroyed their lives. I mean, this is what's happening up and down the coast. And the reason it's happening is not for a legal reason. The Obama administration could absolutely take control over the cleanup operation, and that's mm-hmm. different than taking control over what's happening at the blowout site, at the well site. I mean, they can make the plausible argument that BP is the experts there, but the idea that you would parlay that expertise, that deep water expertise, to the shore expertise, to dealing with the media, to controlling the data, that's just a huge stretch. And the reason it's happening is because Obama wants to make speeches like he made last night, where he points the finger at BP and says he's not happy with the cleanup, as if this isn't his disaster, as if he's not in charge. He wants that distance. He wants to say we're in control at the same time as they're not actually in control. They have people to point the finger at, and this is about the next election.
But there's a tipping point at which that doesn't look strong anymore. Julie, I'll come right to you. Let me just get Carl in New York. Lancaster, New York. Carl, you're on.
Yes, hi. I have a lot of points I'd like to make here. Number one of the foremost of which, though, first of all, I just want to congratulate the president on 2 points from last night, that is the escrow fund, or at least the pledge to create an escrow fund, and also a recommitment to a green future like he promised in the campaign. Unfortunately, what this crisis has really demonstrated is that that government is woefully organized to deal with major disasters, particularly environmental disasters, and that has a lot to do with the way, even though people like to deny it, just what happened in the previous 8 years, which, you know, there's just a lot of unraveling that has to be done.
Carl, I think you got the radio distracting you in the background there, and I'm sorry for that, but we got your point on the government, you say, not set up to address this. Julie, I know you've been bumping to get in there.
There are a lot of things to say about that. But we saw that in Katrina. We're seeing it now, except that I think Naomi is exactly right. We may not be experts in stopping the flow of oil, but President Obama is the president of the United States, the leader of the free world. He is in the Oval Office. I mean, he used that last night, but, you know, 50-some-odd days into it. Why is it that the first day that he's meeting with the BP guys today? He should have had Tony into his Oval Office. I mean, literally call him on the carpet, the Oval Office carpet, and say, we want information, we want this, we're going to take over this cleanup. I mean, go to Congress and say, look, I know what this law, post-Valdez law, said that, you know, the oil companies are in charge. Let them be in charge of the immediate problem, but we're going to be in charge of this cleanup and mobilize and, I mean, not wait this long. I mean, we've got oil arriving at the shore that didn't have to arrive at the shore. You've got BP hiring contractors and subcontractors that have no idea what they're doing out there stumbling around on the beach, in some ways doing worse damage to the environment than if they just weren't walking along. I mean, you see them tromping on pelican eggs. I mean, it's just tragic. But I can't imagine. I mean, I'm just astonished. I mean, the mind boggles why he didn't use his presidential powers to put pressure on these guys from the beginning. I mean, we had to get a high-resolution video leaked to a cable television network by a member of Congress in order to get a better idea what this bill is. Two times in just the past 6 days.
Well, he's got him on the carpet today. He tried to put things on a high plane as well, though, about the future, which Carl also asked about. And let's listen just for a second to President Obama last night saying we've got to change the energy future.
For decades, we have known the days of cheap and easily accessible oil were numbered. For decades, we've talked and talked about the need to end America's century-long addiction to fossil fuels. And for decades, we have failed to act with the sense of urgency that this challenge requires. Time and again, the path forward has been blocked, not only by oil industry lobbyists, but also by a lack of political courage and candor.
Naomi Klein, do you see America shifting onto a new track in energy terms around this disaster?
Well, for that to happen, there would have to be an ambitious plan put on the table and a real vision. And you know, when you know, it is true. I did write a book about how the right has used disasters to push through unpopular policies that the electorate didn't want. But Obama actually has an electoral mandate to move the country to a green future. He ran on that platform. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing undemocratic about using this moment to push for something much more ambitious than the current energy bill on the table, which is what he's done, which will not lead to anywhere near the types of emission reductions that we need to combat climate change, and have huge giveaways for so-called clean coal. He could be talking about a carbon tax, for instance, and we haven't seen any of that type of ambition.
What do you see, Douglas Brinkley, in this president, the way his sails are set, that leaves him at this juncture maybe without the vehicle to go to a really aggressive turn in energy policy here? What does it say about the president?
Well, I mean, I think, first off, it's very clear that the White House and BP are working in tandem. It's a Punch and Judy act, the idea that
collusion.
He's going to chastise BP 1 minute and then the next minute they're together. They've been working in unison. This is a BP White House, the federal government response. They don't want BP destroyed as a company. They don't want BP to leave the Gulf. They don't want them to stop drilling. So we're dealing with the fourth largest company of the world in the United States, and there everything that's going on is being choreographed between the two. It's like big time wrestling. At times it seems like there's a villain in the White Knight, but in truth it's a show, and we're all being subjected to it right now. The bottom line is that because the federal government had problems with MMS, that this Interior Department decided to do a lot of talk about treasured landscapes but abandon it. They greenlit more offshore oil exploration. They never designated and closed off truly sacred landscapes. You know, President Bush, last president, put aside on the Western Hawaiian Islands the largest marine national monument, a huge environmental act that President Bush didn't get much credit for. What has the president done about land and marine policy in the United States? Nothing. Nothing concrete. No new national parks. There's fights for new national parks in Big Sur or the North Woods in Maine. Two Republican senators want a new national park in the north of Maine, and you're not getting it from this administration. They've very big business-oriented. They really don't have the feel for the American landscape. So when you start talking about energy and jobs and green tomorrow, yes, I'm glad the president's addressing it. But this is a nation in crisis right now, and there's some very clear-cut things that could be done by executive orders to help protect the wetlands of Louisiana. And where it's not. There's a moratorium around, but no, we need to designate places to say no to. It's the last month. We've had a long conservation movement in this country, from Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot to William O. Douglas to Lyndon Johnson. I mean, this is the last big moment to designate wilderness areas, marine areas, and protect North America from corporate devastation. And it's going to happen to some of these places when you start opening up public lands to unregulated oil drilling or mining. Theodore Roosevelt called companies despoilers, and the role of the government is to whack them. I feel what we've got between President Obama and Tony Hayward is an agreement, not really a whacking, a little bit of martial language put, but it's going to be business as usual in 6 months because we're probably going to be on petroleum for the next 20 years.
But Julia, the president can't get a single Republican vote in the Senate, even for the energy bill as it stands, which Naomi says isn't strong enough. Not one.
Well, that may change. But I think more important, like I said, is in the short haul. I mean, I think absolutely we should look at our energy policy. But in the short haul, I'm so much more interested in what is happening in the here and now on the ground here in Louisiana while we're just watching minutes tick away and the oil keeps flowing. The other place I think he's thinking small, and I mean, and everybody's lauded him for this escrow fund, which he, as Doug totally correctly points out, is you know, a done deal, and certainly not something they're hammering out as we speak.
We'll see.
But you know, let's say it has $20 million, but we're still not looking
billion. Yeah,
I mean billion dollars. Yeah, we're still not looking at the complete effects of this tragedy. I mean, if you go down to Grand Island, you talk to Dean Blanchard. He's the biggest shrimp processor in the country. He stands to lose $90 million this year. What that means, that's terrible for him, and it's terrible for the shrimpers that are out of business right now, and as Naomi points out, most of the time can't even, you know, are begging for work from BP and not getting it. But what that means is what's been happening for the last several years. It's just like the oil fund, that we've let imports from China and Vietnam and South America that Europe won't even allow in their country in here. So the rest of the country will go on to those imports, which is already decimating our shrimp industry, and we've lost that industry forever.
Naomi,
unless we get this oil out of here.
Naomi, just 20 seconds here. What's nature telling us?
I think it's telling us that clean, safe fossil fuels are a myth, and the worst thing that could happen out of this disaster is us fooling ourselves into believing that all we need is some kind of technical fix, a better blowout preventer, and then business as usual. And I think what's so important about what Douglas has been saying about restoration is there are jobs in restoration, and there are jobs that will break this abusive cycle. Where
we hear it, and that's all we've got time for. Naomi Klein, Julia Reed, Douglas Brinkley, thank you so much to each of you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.